I didn't have much time to prepare it because we have this. I think yesterday you had Joe Minahan, who was telling a little bit about the conference. And this conference is sort of my brainchild with some my former student Niklas Beisert and also Volodya Kazakov. So we set up a new series of conferences, and so I'm very, very heavily engaged in this. But I'll still, tell you a little bit about what I'm doing. And in some senses, presumably, I have no idea what Joe told you, but I'm assuming it will be rather similar in some ways, at least in terms of the topic. So let me just write out my name. More times, so this is a German name, Matthias Staudacher. And I'm from the Humboldt University in Berlin. So, in fact, I thought I'd start by giving you a very short sketch of my biography because it might be interesting for some of you. It's sort of an international career in the sense that I was born in Munich. And then, after my high school diploma, I went to Heidelberg for 2 years. And then I got a Fulbright scholarship, which was this kind of scholarship where I could, the idea was to be an exchange student for a year somewhere in the US. So I think it's very similar to what you guys have won. It's really sort of like a little bit like winning in the lottery. It's great. You just go to a new country and you get money for it. And you can sort of do what you want because, in principle, it's just an exchange thing. So, in principle, I was a non-degree undergraduate student, which sort of meant that I guess nobody was really watching what I was doing. So I could have had just fun. But actually, I was really, into physics and math. So then I just tried to take interesting courses in University of Illinois. So I was probably maybe slightly older than you, but more or less your age. And yeah, so then the first problem was that I wanted to, some of the interesting courses were all what they called graduate courses. And I had no idea what a graduate course was because we have a different system in Germany. We don't really have this undergraduate graduate system. So then the first problem was that there was these university officials which basically said, you are undergraduate, you can't take these courses. So then basically I just sat in for a few weeks in them and then got the professors to write some little note to the admissions office that I can take these courses. Yeah, so that was the first sort of fight, little fight with administration. And then somehow the professors really, I guess they, I liked the courses, they liked me. And it was a totally new experience because at that time in Germany, it was, in Germany we have a different system. We have these kind of mass universities where it's both, we are supposed to do, I mean, the researchers are supposed to do world-class research and educate the masses. So it's like elite university together with sort of many, many community colleges in some sense. It's just a different system. That's why also German universities never rank so high because they have a different, I mean, it's just a totally different setup. So anyway, but the experience was very different from German university in the sense that I was amazed that professors actually were interested in me. Because in Germany, my experience in those 2 years where I studied before, there was they have this 1 hour office hours a week, and then they don't really want to talk to you, basically. That was great. And then I liked it so much, so I stayed. So I actually got my master's there. I got my PhD. I went 1 year to Chicago because my advisor went to Chicago. So it was really great. Got my PhD, and then I went on to go do a postdoc in Rutgers University, which was also, it's between Princeton and New York. It was great. So I stayed 8 years in the state instead of the 1 year, which is, it was supposed to be an exchange program, but I just stayed. And then I did 2 further years as a postdoc in Paris at the École Normale, and then 2 further years at CERN. I'm sure you all have heard of it. At the time, it was the accelerator was LEP. Now it's LHC. And yeah. So on the way, I picked up some French and so on. For this, really, it's great. I mean, so after 12 years, I went back to Potsdam in Germany. That's the Albert Einstein Institute for Gravitational Research, and that was great. I mean, that also it was in the former East Germany, and the wall had conveniently collapsed a few years before I went back, so I could go there. It's a great chance. And then I had like pure research job for 12 years, just no teaching, and was a permanent job. But then at some point I felt, you know, research is fun, I want to continue to do it, but I also want to now start giving something back, you know, to people like you. And then I decided to become a professor now in Humboldt, which is, involves research but also teaching. So it was a voluntary decision. I didn't have to do this. And it is a lot more work than I was used to in the other 12 years at Albert Einstein Institute, but it's fun. I like it. Okay, so that much for my biography. And anyway, what you can get from this is, you know, this kind of thing you want is a big chance. So if you work hard, you have a chance at some international career in theoretical physics, which I just love it. I don't want any other job. I mean, this is perfect job for me. So you have to see, but it's a chance. So don't miss it. What am I working on? Let me write some little diagram, which is. Is it a good idea to start with this one, with this board? Or probably, right? And anyway, I don't think I need all that much space, so let's see. I'm working in a funny field, which is very interdisciplinary, also within theoretical physics, because it ties up elementary particle physics, string theory, so very esoteric subjects, but also quite practical calculations in elementary particle physics, and it relates also to condensed matter theory. And I really, you know, if there's one thing I learned in my career is that theoretical physics is somehow one. I mean, there's no, you can't say I'm just a particle theorist and I'm not interested in condensed matter or something. It's very important to look a little bit beyond what you're doing and just try to learn all the techniques in theoretical physics, because it's really, in the end, the same. There's a very limited number of tricks that work somehow in most of the fields, and you should learn them. This stands for QFT2, where 2 means 2 dimensions. This is QFT4, where 4 means 4 dimensions. So that's 2-dimensional quantum field theory. And that's 4-dimensional quantum field theory. And I guess most of you didn't have so much exposure yet to quantum field theory, but you should learn it well. It's just a universal tool which works for many, many, many interesting things. And SST is super string theory. Okay. Now it turns out that somehow 2-dimensional quantum field theory and 4-dimensional quantum field theory and superstring theory are somehow all related. So let me write a 10 here. Because so the 2 is actually 1 plus 1, 1 space, 1 time. It's you know, some kind of toy system of the world where you are, instead of have 3 spatial dimensions, only 1, but you have time. And that's 1 plus 3. Here you have the full 3 dimensions, and that's time. And that's just 1 plus 9. So in superstring theory, for consistency reasons, you always need one time dimension and 9 spatial dimensions. Now, naively, you would think that I'm sure you have heard of dualities and that, you know, say in easing models, there's a weak, strong coupling duality and so on and so forth. And many things can be dual to each other. It's an exciting field. But most dualities are actually in the same dimension, at least. You know, one thing in one dimension is dual to another thing in the same dimension. Now, what we learned in the last 12 years or so is that actually dimension is becoming less and less important, or rather dimension can hide. So you have to be very careful when you say that a certain system is a theory in a certain number of dimensions, because it could be that there's further hidden dimensions, or it could be that some of the dimensions you have, you should actually somehow hide away and not look at them as real dimensions. Yeah. And that's somehow what really seems to be true in certain theoretical systems. And I do believe that somehow this that nature is trying to hide the nature is trying to hide the nature of dimension from us, I think is very deep and somehow is used in nature, I mean, this principle. So I think if you learned one thing from string theory, you know, it got lots of bad press, maybe in the last few years. But I mean, one great question string theory asks, I think, is really, what's the space-time dimension we live in? And if you just, you know, be narrow-minded and say, okay, I'm a physicist, I only work in four-dimension period, I think you will not succeed in the end. So I don't know how much of string theory is really true, you know, but I think that's one beautiful thing that came out of it, that it questions even this kind of basic question. Like, I think we should explain why we live in 1 + 3 dimension. So so now this whole thing is complex. And I think you probably heard something about this yesterday from Joe. It's a so-called ADS-CFT duality, which leads one example for such a triangle, where somehow all these systems are related to each other. Yeah. Next imperatively. So how does this work? Well, we don't really understand very well yet how that works. Let me explain a little bit the various connections here. So that's an QFT2 and superstring theory, that's an old connection. In fact, what is a superstring? A superstring is a supersymmetric, but that's not so important. Basically, it's generalization of a point. Strings are generalizations of point particles. So, you know, if you have a propagating particle, you make this kind of line. And if you have a propagating string, you say if it's a closed string, you have a little ring that propagates, yeah? And then these particles, they can split or they can join, and that is very much related to so-called Feynman diagrams. And likewise, somehow these tubes, they can split and join. But one nice thing about string theory is that there's something very geometric about the way they split and join. I mean, in the end, actually, if you try to make a more complicated diagram, and for particles, you can make phi to the 3, phi to the 4, or phi to the 5 interactions, and so on. And it's sort of arbitrary what you do here. But just pictorially, you can sort of see that if you try to make a 5-4 graph here, then somehow, in some sense, it's composed of, in a geometric way, of these phi-3 graphs. Yeah, so that's one nice feature of string theory. So that will be the analog of a phi-3 interaction, that a phi-4, just like this is a phi-4 interaction, and this is a phi-3 interaction. So that's one of the nice aspects of string theory. Now, what do we do with these? Just like these particles move in some space-time, and if they move in d-dimensional space-time, usually in the quantum theory, in the relativistic quantum theory, these particles are described by d-dimensional quantum field theory, yeah, QFTD in my notation. Now, these things have to be embedded also somewhere. And so you just embed these strings, again, in d-dimension. But then, as quite different from quantum field theory, I mean, dimension is also important in the theory of renormalizability of quantum field theories. But you, in principle, in any dimension, you can write some kind of consistent quantum field theory. That's not true in string theory. So somehow they have to live in fixed number of dimensions. And the superstrings, which are somehow the most realistic ones in many ways, they have to live in 10 dimensions. So you embed, so I should make some big error, embed this in time, and then you have x, y, z, a, b, and so on, up to 9. Yeah. So that's sort of now. Why is there this connection? Because you can have now two points of view about these strings. You can say that you have a kind of a two-dimensional quantum field theory, because a cylinder like this you can think of as a rolled up, like here you have space and time, yeah, I mean, you could say that this direction is space, and this direction is time. So you can think of this as a kind of a two-dimensional space-time, and that at each point I have to say where the point at the string is embedded in the 10-dimensional space. So I can think of this 10-dimensional space as a kind of, it's called the target space, as a kind of a field that lives on this two-dimensional surface. So you can look at string theory as a two-dimensional quantum field theory, where space-time is kind of just a field living on this space, one plus one-dimensional space-time. That's one point of view. And the other one is the one I already said. There's a 10-dimensional point of view, where you say you just have a 10-dimensional space-time, but we don't have particles, we have strings. So here we go. Somehow, there's a so-called world sheet description, the one where you think of the fundamental thing as the two-dimensional world sheet, or a space-time description where you think about the 10-dimensional thing as a fundamental thing and something moving in there. So that sort of explains the first thing here. Now, the other thing is much more surprising, because now, theorists, string theory has a very funny history, and you can read about this. It's quite interesting. I mean, so it was actually first designed to explain certain phenomena in the theory of nuclear forces, so the so-called strong forces. And it was sort of initially designed just before QCD, and then QCD sort of killed it. But still, the idea never completely died, so people still, and to this day, they try somehow reformulate QCD now as some kind of string theory. And QCD is, of course, a four-dimensional quantum field theory. But one of the problems is that string theories really have to live in 10 dimensions. Yeah. So, and that's where a lot of progress was made in the last 12 years. And that's really this ADS-CFT correspondence. We still don't have really this QFT for the moment cannot be QCD. It's certain brothers and sisters of QCD, which are in many ways simpler. But in a few cases, we now found some QCD-like, let me call it. Really, they are quite different physically, but let me still call them QCD-like theories. Some QCD-like theories, which are described by strings. So that's this error. And that's really an amazing thing. I think there will be even one course in your program, 10-month program, I heard about this ADS-CFT. So it will explain a little bit more about this connection. Let me just say a little bit, just a tiny bit more about the space-time. You cannot, for the moment, for this to work, you cannot just take any 10-dimensional space-time. You have to take a very special one. And what you take is something funny. You have to take a 10-dimensional space, but what you actually take is you take a so-called ADS space, where ADS stands for ADS equals anti de Sitter. And at each point of this ADS space, and you take a five-dimensional such space. So you have like in the plane here, you have sort of two directions. Let's call them 0 and 5. And then up here, I can't draw it, obviously. We have like four further dimensions, 1, 2, 3, 4. So it's total, I'm drawing this because this is a surface in a six-dimensional space. So 0, 1, 2, 5 is six dimensions. And I'm basically embedding this kind of hyperboloid into the six-dimensional space. So this is a five-dimensional object, yeah? And then at each point, I attach a sphere, but not an ordinary sphere, but a five-dimensional sphere. So we have a sphere, and that's called S5, just five-dimensional sphere. Yeah. So there's sort of now there's really 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6 dimensions in all these directions, and that's a surface in the six-dimensional space, so it's a five sphere. Yeah? And then I'm embedding these superstrings. So super just means that there are certain fermionic degrees of freedom living on this world sheet. I'm embedding this into the space. And then the funny statement is that the strings moving in this space are a certain four-dimensional quantum field theory, and the QFT is so-called n equals 4 super Young-Mills theory. Yeah, and that's an amazing thing because it's a surprising conjecture which was proposed by Maldacena in 1997. And now we have accumulated lots and lots of evidence that this is just completely and exactly true. So this four-dimensional Young-Mills theory is identical to this 10-dimensional superstring theory, which is just embedded in this space. And then you can have lots of fun trying to understand how the gauge theory in the four dimensions are hiding in here. So let me just give a little hint. So first of all, these five dimensions here, they are again sort of like fields in the quantum field. They look like a flavor index, these indices. And then somehow, in a way I don't have time now to explain, the Minkowski space somehow is in some funny way embedded into this five-dimensional space, or the four-dimensional space in this. And the time actually runs like this around this circle here. And then that looks like a picture from science fiction, because if you look at this, it looks like you have a closed time-like curve. And what you actually have to do, so the geometry is quite quite involved. And if you like math, you can have really fun with this geometry. What actually happens to make all this consistent is you have to go to a different so-called Riemann sheet. So maybe you've heard of covers. So it's like Riemann. I mean, like the sheets of an analytic function, so you go around, but you're not back at the same, at where your grandfather was born or something like this, but sort of on another sheet. And then you keep going. So that's how that works. So there's lots of, you know, crazy things which may or may not be used in nature, but in this system, they are definitely used, these kind of ideas. Yeah. Okay. So, and what is this n equals 4 super Young-Mills theory? That's just a 1 plus 3 dimensional gauge theory. And these gauge theories, they are hugely important. In fact, out of all the possible 4-dimensional quantum field theories, it seems like for some reason, which is also not very well understood, that nature on the level of elementary particles only makes use of so-called gauge theories. So I don't know if I can't explain this now, but the basic thing you need to learn, and it's so-called non-abelian gauge theories in general. So what you write down, if you know what a Lagrange density is, you write something like 1/4 a trace f mu nu. And these f's are, this is an SUN gauge theory, and these f's are n by n matrices. So don't worry if you don't understand this. You will learn about this, I'm sure, in these 10 months. And actually, that's already the right ingredient for that stuff occurs in this very form in nature, basically. So in nature, we have several of these f's. In fact, that is something, again, I'm assuming you have heard somewhere, the actual gauge theory which is used for the electromagnetic, the weak and the strong interactions is a U1 cross SU2 cross SU3 theory. So that's this gauge group, SUN in this case. So you need sort of 1 and 2 and 3, so the lowest cases. And the U1 is just the quantum electrodynamics, you know. The SU2 is the weak interactions. So together they are unified in the so-called electroweak interactions. And then the SU3 is doing, that's QCD. If you just stick to that, that's sort of the QCD part. That's the strong interactions. So the whole thing is the gauge group of the so-called standard model. Young-Mills theory is a fantastic example for theoretical physicist thought, because basically it was born in the early 50s when people started to understand the quantum field theory of electromagnetism, the so-called U1 gauge theory. And just some theorists had this idea, you know, just they knew some math. So the mathematical sophistication in the 50s of theoretical physics was much, much lower than today. But still, there were a few fancy theorists who knew what a little bit of group theory and what non-Lie groups are. And then they had this idea, let's see what happens if we try to do a quantum electrodynamics, but not with U1, but with SU2 or SU3 and so on. And that led to some beautiful math. So this was, in particular, it was Yang, yeah, Chinese physicist. And it was Mills, I guess, a British theorist, if I'm not wrong. And they found some very fun structures. But they there was a little problem, because these, just like the U1 theory has a photon, which is a massless particle, you just get more and more of these massless force carriers in these kind of gauge theories. So then actually the number of force carriers goes with the number of elements of the Lie group. If you know, I think I just sneaked in before you just learned what SU2 was and so on. So SU2 has three generators. So there's not one photon here, but three photons. And SU3 has eight generators, so there's sort of eight photons, which are actually called gluons in the theory. And then people sort of, most theorists, threw these didn't take them seriously or threw them away immediately, because beyond the photon, you just don't see any manifest, massless force carriers like that. And that's a beautiful example for, you shouldn't give up too early, because it took many, many years to understand that these force carriers for the SU2 and the SU3 gauge series, they are there. They're just sort of hiding in a clever way. Yeah. So and they're hiding actually in very different ways. So in SU2, and that's probably something you will learn in these 10 months also, what happens is SU2, the three force carriers here, they basically acquire through what's called the Higgs mechanism a mass. They become very, very heavy. And they were only like, they are basically this so-called Z0 and W plus, W minus particles. So they were only discovered some 20 years ago at CERN. And, 25 or. And so that's, you shouldn't give up too early. And this kind of mechanism actually is a condensed matter-like mechanism. It actually, in some sense, appeared first in condensed matter theory. So again, an example why it's really important to understand condensed matter. So even though most people didn't take this Young-Mills theory seriously, it just turned out that these massless particles, you can make them massive with some beautiful theoretical mechanism taken from condensed matter. And then in the SU3 case, again, something else happens. There, in some sense, they stay massless. But because of some phenomenon called asymptotic freedom, basically these, in this case, eight photon-like things called gluons, which keep somehow the neutrons and protons intact, they can't escape through a mechanism which is, again, sort of a condensed matter-like mechanism. It's called confinement, and I'm sure you have heard of it. So somehow these particles are confined. So totally different story as for SU2, but very exciting and very interesting. And so that's it. So and now many people actually always cite this Young-Mills theory as an example for what might one day happen with string theory. It's a beautiful thing. People are having fun with it. Somehow you can't really apply it to nature in a very good way for the moment, but it's too beautiful not to be used by nature somewhere. Yeah, and that's what some people felt with Young-Mills theory. In the case of Young-Mills theory, it definitely was true. Admittedly, there it only took some 15 years or so, or even less, before people understood how to use it. In string theory, it's taking a lot longer. But who knows? I mean, somehow, personally, I believe that beautiful structures are used somewhere I mean, in theoretical physics, I used summer in nature. And in the end, might be some totally, maybe we'll find some superstring and some tabletop experiment and some condensed matter system, who knows. But I'm convinced it will appear somewhere, but I'm not at all convinced that, that we have found the right application for superstring theory yet. Yeah? So, and by the way, just as a little warning, there was another guy, that's an interesting story. I only know a sketch of the story. I don't know all the details, but it seems like Abdus Salam in the ITEP in Trieste, there's this international center. He gave to one of his students, I think it was called Shaw, this problem of replacing U1 by SUN. And then he worked it out, I mean, the student, and then he found these massless particles, and then he said, no, I'm a real physicist. I'm not going to publish that trash. We don't have such particles. And that's how he missed becoming famous. I mean, it could have been young Mills Shaw theory. You know, just as a little warning. So don't give up too early. Okay, so I want to come soon to the end so to allow you for some questions. So basically, I'm certainly excited about these kind of ideas for the moment, and I would like to try. And we still don't understand this connection very well here. It's really an amazing thing that a four-dimensional thing can be a 10-dimensional thing. And one very important aspect of that, so let me give you a sketch how all this happens. So I guess now I have to learn how to try to avoid it. But so I'll do rear. Let's see. I'll just put the middle one down, I guess. Okay, and the rear one up. Hey, cool. So, yeah. So how does this work roughly? I mean, I can only give you a sketch, but so what? One thing you will learn in those 10 months is, I'm assuming, that you'll really learn the quantum field theory of these Young-Mills theories. And these photos I was just talking about, they're usually in Feynman diagram language. They are this kind of curly line. So in QED, this is a photon. In the SU2 theory, it's, like I said, W plus minus or Z0, yeah? Or in QCD, the SU3 case, it's just one of the 8 gluons. So you have to make an index, in you know. So this runs from 1 to 3 in SU2 theory and from 1 to 8 in SU3 theory and so on. And in general, it runs from 1 to n squared minus 1 for SUN, yeah, this index. Now, there was a clever guy called Toft who had a nice idea. So he just said, hey, these fields are, if I'm non-abelian, so if I have anything beyond U1, so SU2, SU3, SU4, these are really matrices, the gauge fields, okay? So let me just, instead of using this what's called an adjoint index, let me just use a matrix notation and just split this gluon line, okay? So instead of using A, you have ij. And then if I runs from 1 to n, and j runs from 1 to n, then you see that you have n squared different particles here. And here you have n squared minus 1, but that's because this is SUN, and that's sort of the one particle is missing because it's SUN. If it was UN, it would be exactly n squared, okay? And then in Young-Mills theory, as opposed to U1 theory, quantum electrodynamics, these gluons, I guess that's one of the reasons why they are called gluons, because they're really gluey. They sort of, they build some kind of goo and stick together and so on and so forth. So they interact with themselves. There's these kind of vertices. So the gluons interact with themselves. And then in this nice notation, you just get these little stripes here. That was wrong. That was a phi 3. And then, and I guess I could do these arrows here. So sort of like quarks, anti-quarks, in some sense, these arrows. So then what Toft said, hey, this is interesting. This looks like, you know, one thing you can say is it just looks like a double line, and that's it. But if you look very closely, there's something interesting here, because you can think of this not as two like disconnected line, but you can sort of fill it in a little bit with some little something and say this is just a band, like a belt or something. Yeah, so it's a strip. And when you make the Feynman graphs from these guys in this double line notation, you get something what mathematicians call fat graphs. So they are Feynman graphs, but they are fat. They are fattened out. And in fact, they make, because of this band structure, they make little surfaces. And you can show that if you take n very large, that you kill all the graphs which are not really surface-like and have all these intersections and so on. So the so-called planar graphs survive in the large n limit. Large n limit, planar graphs. And that's sort of the first point of contact with this stringy ideas, because you know, if we have our string here propagating, then you can think of in the gauge theory somehow that basically there is all these particles here somehow moving on the cylinder. And they have this surface light structure, so they fill out the cylinder. And then if you had a torus or something, then you would get what's not a non-planar diagram. So you can make a band. You can make a little vertex here. And then you can say that this band wraps the torus like this. But then this band wraps in the other direction. That's a kind of diagram that goes to zero if n goes to infinity. Okay, and this one survives. And that's actually very much like in string theory, where you can say that to leading order, if I suppress the interaction, I just survive, these kind of tubes survive. Okay, so here we have the first idea of which is used in ADS-DFT, that in this large n planar limit, you get free string theory, where the strings are not allowed to split and join. So that's just one element of this idea. And again, it goes back to some idea of Toft from the beginning of the 70s. So, and now to finish up, give you one more element. No, I didn't do it so well. So what happened? Let's see. Where did my I'm puzzled. Where did my picture go? Aha! Uh-huh. Oh, it's because yeah. Okay. Anyway, you. I don't think I need what I had there. Well, I could. I guess I could do it, but do you want it? I think you don't need it. So, yeah, no, but then people get a stiff neck. I mean, I could do that. Yeah, okay. So that's a real challenge. So let's see. And now I do the middle one. Let's see what happens. Hey, yeah. Somehow it's fun, but now I have to. Yeah, I'm sure. I mean, let's see. Now, where was this thing? So this one doesn't move, I see. And now I remember you told me, but. Okay, so now, I already hinted a little bit at various connections between, you know, gauge theory and condensed matter and so on and so forth. Now, yet, I mentioned confinement, and I mentioned the Higgs mechanism. Now, in this system here, there's another very surprising thing, and that relates to something I'm assuming that Joe Minahan told you yesterday. Another condensed matter-like thing appears here. And the way that works, in fact, one of the things people are interested in, people in condensed matter are interested in, are so-called spin chains. And to give one example, it's say the so-called XYZ spin chain. And these spin chains, that's just a very simple Hamiltonian problem. Basically, you have a closed chain, and it's actually a lattice which with periodic boundary conditions. And in the simplest case, for ADS-DFT, we don't need the simplest case, but a much more complicated one. But just to illustrate the idea, you can have these spins. And in the simplest case, the spin is in the spin 1/2 representation. Again, your morning's lecture. So basically, the Pauli matrices act on the spin chain. And then you just have some Hamiltonian, which is you sum from 1 to L, where L is the number of sites, the length of the spin chain. And then you have some coupling. So here we have the Pauli matrices, which I think I saw on the wall in what you just heard. So there are three of them, X, Y, and Z, and they are coupled in a nearest neighbor fashion. So L is labeling the sites here. So we have L equals 1 here, L equals 2 here, L equals 3 here, and here we have L equals big L. My L Z. One Z plus one Z. And now you can see that this is actually the possible states are at each site you have up or down. There's two states. So actually, the state space of the thing is just 2 to the L states. So it's clear. It should be clear that this H is just a 2 to the L by 2 to the L matrix. And one thing you should also learn very, very, very well for your future career, you should learn linear algebra. So the Schrödinger equation for the system is nothing but the eigenvalue problem, where you act on some state, where a state is a spin chain here. So I can think a specific state of the spin chain with some ket. And then I get some energy if I have an eigenstate psi. So you have a very concrete 2 to the L by 2 to the L matrix, and you just try to find its eigenvalues. E are the eigenvalues of H. And that kind of problem is ubiquitous in condensed matter. Of course, in condensed matter, very often we are interested in not one-dimensional spin chains, but I guess three-dimensional or two-dimensional and so on and so forth. But in the lab, you can, to some degree, even prepare these one-dimensional systems. I mean, there have been, you can make some kind of tabletop experiments which sort of describe one-dimensional spin chains. And these spin chains also have a very interesting history, because actually the first one, where jx equals jy equals jz, it was sort of defined and solved at the very beginning, early days of quantum mechanics, namely in 1931 by Hans Bethe, who then was a sort of very young postdoc in Rome. And again, he had some kind of fellowship from the Rockefeller Foundation. I don't know how the Rockefeller Foundation allowed some German Jew to go to Rome on some money. It's very nice, but it happened. And you know, he could have just gone sightseeing and have fun in Rome, but somehow he sat down and solved this problem, finding H psi equals E psi. And wrote a very, very famous paper. And you can solve this kind of thing by what's called Bethe-Ansatz. And I'm assuming that Joe maybe said something about this yesterday. So it's a very old problem, but it's one of these things, one of these techniques, you know, which became, you know, somehow very standard now in many fields of condensed matter. But it's such a beautiful idea and beautiful thing that it just keeps reappearing in all kinds of funny fields of theoretical physics, or even, like, I think it occurred even in information theory and so on and so forth. But it certainly, and that's what happened about 6 or 7 years ago, and that's one of the things I was involved with, we just discovered that these spin chains, a little bit more complicated versions than that, just also appear in this ADS CFT. So, and you know, and I have to admit that when I was in Illinois, I didn't care too much about condensed matter, and it was a huge mistake. I mean, I'm sure you know, I wrote some nice papers on this, but I could have written even much, I mean, more papers if I had known more. I had to learn all that stuff. So learn it now. You will not, you know, you will not regret it. So yeah. Anyway, and then just I'll finish by saying you what this has to do with these kind of pictures I drew, because basically you can now somehow say that I told you that the gluons are somehow these double lines, and I told you that they kind of one rough way to see how the gauge theory somehow has something to do with the string theory is that in the large n limit somehow these gluons can be drawn on a cylinder, which is sort of the cylinder of the world sheet of the string. And now you can sort of make some other nice picture where you sort of say, we have, roughly speaking, maybe two kinds of gluons, like solid lines and dashed lines. Yeah, so here's my cylinder. So it's, you know, it's not exactly gluons, but just for the sake of the argument, let me cheat a little bit. It's very close to that in the theory. In this Engels four theory, so you have two kinds of these particles appearing in this gauge theory, and then what they can meet, and then just through the Young-Mills interaction, basically this guy which is down here, the guy where four gluons meet, yeah, the dashed particle and the undashed particle can exchange, and then you can just say roughly that this is an upspin. And this is a downspin. And then when they exchange through the Feynman diagram, basically you can say that's one of these interactions this kind of Hamiltonian is doing. It's just exchanging the spins. So basically, somehow to find the spectrum of the string theory, where you somehow try to find the spectrum of the strings, how they move, how the cylinder sort of wobbles, is related to the problem of the diagonalization of this type of a spin chain, where somehow up and down spins exchange, and you have to do this kind of complicated, complicated looking diagonalization, but it is much simpler than you initially think, because of what's called integrability, what Bethe discovered, namely that you can use this Bethe ansatz. So that's the discovery of integrability. So this. Basically, integrability of the kind Bethe accidentally discovered with his scholarship in Rome is reoccurring, you know, something like 80 years later in this very sophisticated ADS CFT system. So that was my message from the beginning, like just try to learn all of the methods of theoretical physics, because they can just appear in all kinds of contexts, and good ideas and good, I mean, again, somehow nature, maybe I shouldn't say nature, because admittedly we haven't yet understood how nature makes use of ADS CFT. I somehow cannot believe it doesn't make, it's too beautiful, as I said. But it is a very sophisticated and interesting system. And these very, very old ideas are somehow eternal. I mean, they don't die. They don't become efficient. They just crop up again, and some 80 years later, in this very complicated gauge string, super string thing, suddenly these spin chains reappear. So that's my message for today. Don't be shy, just ask me anything. I don't know, what did Joe tell you yesterday? Was it also about the spin chains? I didn't talk to him.
No, mm-hmm. More precise.
More precise, yeah. Very good. So
he sort of did it in reverse order.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
It started with the spin chains and then went eventually to the string.
Very good. Yeah, I should say this kind of field is you know, it's very, very rich, and we are very far from understanding this ADS CFT thing. So I think it's a great research topic. And it allows you, if you learn that stuff, you will have lots of physics friends, because like I said, you know. In fact, it's really that was another reason why, in some sense, I felt I should move from the Albert Einstein Institute, because really focusing on just gravitational research and saying this kind of thing, it's very important to have some, say, condensed matter theorists around you can talk to. So you shouldn't be too specialized in your research. I think that's very
okay. Thank you very much. Mm-hmm.